So have you recovered from the excitement that was our first quiz hosted together this week, Dominic?
No, not really. I've been lying down in a dark room ever since, which is maybe a bad sign. But no, I actually had a really nice time and it was so nice seeing everyone.
Our listeners are real people with faces.
It was kind of moving.
It was. I teared up a little bit.
Is that too cheesy to say?
Yeah, but no, it was incredibly nice to see listeners from all over Europe and I think all over the world, in fact. So thank you so much to everyone that took part. It was just a lovely thing to happen.
Yeah, we should do it again sometime, but maybe we'll take a little bit of a break.
Let's have at least a week off. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. I was slightly concerned for you because I saw all these headlines in the Dutch and Belgian news about whether or not to put down Katja Lee, which is basically Katie Lee, your name. Did you see this?
Yes, your husband showed it to me. So what is Katja Lee is a little cat that people were debating whether to put down or not.
Yeah, it's a cat in Belgium that's been making headlines because it was brought back by its owner from Peru and didn't follow the strict quarantining rules against rabies. This woman brought it back to Belgium and the authorities said they were going to have to put it down. And then animal rights activists were like, this is mad. She probably doesn't even have rabies. And it's been a big debate.
I mean, I have been described as rabid in the past, but I think putting me down is a bit much.
It looks like they might give her a reprieve and let her live, which is nice for the cat. But the woman went into hiding with the cat. It's quite a story.
I think often British people as well tend to think that our country is the only one that goes completely mad over animal stories. So it's kind of weirdly comforting to know that this isn't a purely British phenomenon.
That's true. Well, I'll have one more animal story for you later in the show.
Can't wait.
We're not going to be talking about animals all the time this episode, I promise. In fact, we're going to be diving into the Wikiverse later with Rebecca O'Neill, an Irish Wikipedian who is currently in the midst of a self-imposed challenge to write a Wikipedia article every day of the year. Partly to address this thing called Women in Red, whereby there are way more biographies about males on Wikipedia than females. That's not what we say, is it? Men or women.
It makes them sound like sort of biological specimens.
It does. So Rebecca will be joining us later in the show, but for now, I've got a quick commemoration corner for you. A 100 years ago this week, Lithuania's first democratically elected parliament had its first sitting. It was called the Constituent Assembly of Lithuania, and it was elected to draft and adopt the Constitution of Lithuania, which they managed to do 2 years later in 2020. I wrote 2022. I meant 1922.
I was going to say.
Interestingly, the first sitting of the assembly was presided over by a woman, Gabriele Betkavičaitė Bitė, a Lithuanian writer, educator and activist. And it goes without saying that lots has happened in the past 100 years in Lithuania, and that constitution from 1922 is not the constitution of today. Their most recent constitution was passed by referendum in 1992. Anyway, I stumbled across this on Facebook as it was shared by a Lithuanian friend of mine, also called Gabriele, who actually coincidentally sent me a message this week to say that she'd listened to every single one of our episodes during lockdown.
Oh no, not the early ones.
I know, we should delete them. Ah. But happy 100 years to the Constituent Assembly of Lithuania. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Bad week goes to Albania this week, and that is because of a huge controversy over the National Theatre. It's a murky tale. I hope you're ready for it.
Hit me.
So, Albania's National Theatre, it's in central Tirana, and it's a historic building, or it was a historic building. Spoiler alert.
Ooh.
It was built in World War II when Albania was under Italian occupation. And after the war, it was used for show trials by the communists. So it was getting a bit run down. You know, it's been there for a while. But it was a striking building and it carried a lot of history in its walls. A couple of years ago, the Prime Minister, Edi Rama, decided that Albania should have a fancy new national theatre. And he announced that he wanted to knock the building down and start again from scratch.
Why couldn't he have just built a new one in another place and kept the old one?
Two theatres seems like overkill, don't you think, Dominic? Is that a really philistine thing to say?
Yes.
Anyway, local campaigners were really furious about this. They were like, hang on a second, this is a historic building. We should be preserving it and making the existing building better, not knocking it down. To which the Prime Minister replied that these people were anti-development and there was nothing worth saving here, which seems to me like quite a sad thing to say. So for the last couple of years, there's been this really big, ugly dispute over the theatre, and it became really political because it soon emerged that the government was planning to give this piece of prime real estate to one of its favourite construction companies, and the contract included the right to build some new skyscrapers as well. And there was no public competition for different companies to bid for the right to have this contract.
Are they building a skyscraper theatre? I don't understand.
Well, the new design for the theatre does look quite fancy, actually, but it's not a skyscraper. It's going to be in the shape of a big kind of bow tie.
Oh, that sounds kind of cheesy.
That's kind of cool. I don't mind it. But anyway, this whole thing seemed like pretty shady. And for the theatre campaigners, it just smacked of like cronyism and corruption, which have been historically like really big problems in Albania. And I guess actually in a sign that things have moved on to some extent, there was a pretty big scandal over this. And the government finally said, OK, we'll ditch this plan. And now the city have contracted this Danish star architect called Bjarke Ingels to do the design instead. And he's the guy that came up with the giant bow tie.
Oh, I've actually just Googled it and it does look quite cool.
But again, there's no sign that there was a public competition for the right to design this new theatre. So even with this star architect drafted in, the protesters weren't very happy about this whole thing. Until this week, they were holding out hope that they might still be able to save the old theatre. There's a coalition of actors and activists who've been occupying the theatre for months and trying to protect it and also hosting loads of performances and exhibitions there. It's been pretty cool. But sadly, at 4:30 on Sunday morning, an operation began to bulldoze the National Theatre. And the actors and protesters who'd been protecting it were forced out with pepper spray, and things quickly got very ugly with this big, angry crowd gathering and shouting, like, shame, shame at the police. And it really took people by surprise because it seems like this was actually illegal. City Hall had announced that they were going to knock the theatre down, but there's supposed to be a 10-day gap between the decision and that decision getting enacted, and in this case, there was only three. There's been some suggestion that the mayor of Tirana and the prime minister wanted to move fast on this because protests are currently illegal due to the C word. So they might have thought they could get away with bulldozing it without causing too much of a scene. But yeah, that didn't really happen.
This seems to be quite a change of fortunes because things recently have been looking quite good for Albania with EU membership talks moving forward positively.
Yeah, it doesn't look great. There is this kind of whiff of cronyism about the whole thing, which really doesn't look good given that corruption has historically been like the big issue blocking Albania from joining the EU. And, you know, the public weren't consulted over this. The government just charged ahead and literally bulldozed a historic monument. Senior EU figures have said, you know, this isn't really in the spirit of consultation, which is how we do things in the EU. So, yeah, bad week. But I am looking forward to you performing one day in this fancy new theatre and coming to see it.
You're so easily won over just by some fancy new architecture, aren't you, Katie?
I really am. I was on lots of architecture blogs looking at it and none of them mentioned this whole big row. They were like, look at these sweeping curves of this fancy new building.
Yeah, I wonder what the Danish architecture firm think about it, huh?
Well, this is another thing that's quite interesting. So Bjarke Ingels seems like he's not too fussy about the kind of jobs that he takes on. So he recently got into trouble because he's been working for the far-right Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, and also done some projects for the Saudi government. So yeah, not fussy.
Great.
Moving on to Good Week.
Yeah, time for Good Week. We've never given it to her, I don't think, but this week, Angela Merkel is finally receiving the prize she has long waited for. Good Week is yours. I'm not giving it to her because her personal approval ratings have been going up in her closing months as leader of Germany, or because of the reports this week that the AfD, the far-right German party, are in turmoil, although these are clearly both good things for her. No, I'm giving it to her because I was just really impressed with the way she responded to this German intelligence report that came out last week, confirming that a hack from 2015 on the German parliament was indeed conducted by hackers connected to the Russian intelligence services. The report had taken 5 years to be written, and it outlined that they'd traced the source of the 2015 hack to the same Russian intelligence-linked hackers who had also hacked the Democratic Party in America during the election in 2016. They actually even have a specific person that they are seeking to prosecute for this crime, a 29-year-old called Dmitry Badin, who works for the Russian intelligence service and is a member of this hacking group called Fancy Bear. Good name, huh?
Fancy Bear.
And Merkel finds herself in a pretty tough spot, not wanting to push Russia too far away by responding too forcefully, but also not wanting to appear like a pushover. Do you think that's the word that geopolitical strategists use when talking about these things? Don't be too much of a pushover.
Definitely appears in lots of white papers.
So, yeah, good week. Maybe it's a bit stupid to give her good week for this, considering it sounds so far like pretty bad week. But I was just so taken aback by her response to this report. She was clearly distressed by it and annoyed. She said it was outrageous. But she was also really open about the fact that she doesn't want to push back too aggressively. And her response felt really honest and human. She said, "On the one hand, I try to improve relations with Russia on a daily basis. And when then, on the other hand, we see that there is hard evidence that Russian forces are operating in such a way that we are working in a field of tension, which is something that, despite the desire for good relations with Russia, I cannot completely erase from my heart." Merkel talked about the fact that Russia are practicing a strategy of hybrid warfare, and she said, "We always reserve the right to take measures. Nevertheless, I will continue to strive for a good relationship with Russia because I believe that there is every reason to always continue these diplomatic efforts." And I find this kind of language when talking about a hack from a foreign government so unusually balanced and calm and measured, and I couldn't help but be a bit seduced by it. She's not rising to the provocation.
Is this partly because Russia and Germany have quite a close economic relationship, don't they? So I feel like Merkel has to play it really carefully with Putin all the time.
Yeah, although historically she hasn't been soft on Russia. She was one of the strongest voices in pushing for the retention of economic sanctions against Russia that came into force after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. But yeah, Merkel herself grew up in East Germany and speaks Russian, so she is pretty well placed to manage tricky diplomatic situations with Putin. And I think this week she walked that delicate tightrope pretty well. I'm sure some will disagree with my analysis, and I know she is by no means perfect. There's definitely criticism to be made for her championing of Nord Stream 2, you know, this controversial new gas pipeline that's being built from Russia to Germany. Mm. So, yeah, this is maybe a strange good week, and maybe it should actually be a good week for Vladimir Putin. And perhaps if we didn't have so many reactionary populist leaders around right now, I wouldn't have even noticed that her response was impressively frank and calm.
I do think it's quite a classy response, but I don't know, if you look at it from a different angle, you could see it as her acknowledging that Russia is just really hard to deal with and it's really hard to like change Putin's behavior in any way.
That's very true. Although you could also argue that the hack wasn't that successful. I mean, they probably did gain quite a bit of an intelligence from it, and they did take an estimated 16 gigabytes of data, but they got access to Merkel's parliamentary email address, and that was like big news. But then there were reports later that she actually doesn't even use that email address. Ha. So it's unlikely they got any private or sensitive emails from her. But yeah, Putin clearly is very powerful, and he's having some success with this hybrid warfare.
The thing I always remember about Putin and Merkel is that time that he found out that she really is quite scared of dogs.
Oh yeah.
So he like released loads of dogs when they were supposed to be meeting to like freak her out. Isn't that just a horrendous thing to do?
It is monstrous. That's just the worst thing.
Sorry, I've just been reading that it was only one dog. In my head it was a pack of dogs, but that's being okay. Unfair to Putin.
It's only fair to be fair to Putin. He's fair to everyone else, isn't he?
Yep.
Before I stop ranting about Angela Merkel and everyone thinks that I'm her biggest fan, she did one other really good thing this week that I was just really impressed by personally as a musician. I was so moved by the speech she gave about culture in Germany. And seeing how vulnerable all the cultural institutions are right now, I was just really relieved and amazed to see a world leader stressing the importance of culture. And she committed to helping artists through and beyond this crisis. She said that whilst we're waiting to be able to see the wonderful cultural offerings in the flesh again, she was also going to carry on saying how important artists are to us all. So that was just really amazing, I thought. And some other world leaders could take her lead on that, please.
Macron has done a culture plan, but it hasn't actually gone down very well. And like artists and performers are saying it isn't clear enough what kind of support they're going to get. But there was also this weird line in his speech about culture that has become a meme. And it's quite funny. He just randomly started talking about ham, cheese, very tangible things.
Du fromage, du jambon. Des choses très concrètes.
Which I think was like a reference to Robinson Crusoe, the novel, but it came across as very random.
I mean, ham and cheese are culture.
I certainly agree with that.
We also haven't mentioned the fact that Macron and Merkel just announced the other day that they may have reached an amazing deal around bonds, $500 billion deal. For the coronavirus recovery, but no one wants to hear me try and talk about bonds ever again, so let's leave it there for now.
Don't say that. I'm looking forward to next week's bond special. A bond bonanza.
Wow, there's such a good pun in there somewhere, isn't there?
The name's Bond Eurobond.
The name's Bond Eurobonds. Yes, that's it.
That's terrible.
As we said earlier, we had an amazing time with our Patreons this week on Zoom with two pub quizzes. We hope to do another one some point in the future. Who knows? Time moves weirdly at the moment. But we have two new patrons to thank, Suzanne Rodriguez and Natalia Osmolovskaya.
Thank you both so much.
You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
Should we do an interview now?
Yes.
So, as everyone probably knows, we're big fans of Wikipedia on this podcast. It has helped us out on many occasions when frantically trying to learn about any number of things.
Yeah, and in some ways, I guess we're editing Wikipedia articles is the perfect lockdown activity. And that's what Rebecca O'Neill thinks anyway.
Yeah, and I personally don't think enough about the people who have written these pages, who are often just ordinary people who do this as volunteers. Rebecca is one of these people who has spent years contributing to the sum of human knowledge in this way. These days, she actually works for Wikimedia, which is the non-profit that runs Wikipedia. She's their island coordinator. And within what she calls the Wikiverse, she's also part of a movement that is trying to quietly make Wikipedia a more feminist place. One thing I didn't know about Wikipedia is there's actually quite a massive gender imbalance in terms of the pages that actually get written. So only about 18% of the biographies of the people on the English version of Wikipedia are biographies of women. So we rang up Rebecca to talk about that gender imbalance and where it comes from. But actually, we ended up talking about a bunch of other stuff, including regional languages and celebrity deaths, all kinds of things. But we started by asking her why she got hooked on writing Wikipedia pages in the first place.
The main rabbit hole that I fell down was the what's now referred to as the Women in Red project, and it still is referred to as the gender gap at times, which is the fact that back in 2015, on English language Wikipedia, the amount of articles about women was at 15% of all the biographies on that particular project. And it's roughly about the same on most other language Wikipedias. So I discovered that there was a whole host of particularly Irish women that were missing from Wikipedia. And the one that really galled me, I suppose, at the start was a woman called Mary Swansea, who, if you know anything about the history of Irish art, was absolutely central to, she was one of the first Cubist artists in Ireland, an abstract artist, and was hugely influential on a whole host of 20th century Irish artists. So the fact that she was missing, well, if she is missing, who else is going to be missing from it? So that was kind of the spur to start cross-referencing and see who was omitted.
Why do you think it is that so many women were missing on Wikipedia, biographies of them? I mean, obviously there's the patriarchy. That would be a good answer. We can't completely blame Wikipedia. But is it something to do with the demographic of people who are more likely to contribute to Wikipedia?
In the people that have stated their gender on Wikipedia, it's roughly kind of 15 to 20% of editors are women or identify as women. And that plays out in kind of what they're interested in writing about. So the majority of editors are men. They're between the ages of 18 and 30. They have at least a third level degree, you know, a university or college degree. They have no partner and they have no children. So if you think about kind of being wildly stereotypical. Most guns, bullets, tanks, wars will be written about. Trains, planes, and automobiles will be written about. But Cubist artists from Ireland at the turn of the 20th century don't tend to fall into those people's interests. The other element of that is that women and other minorities in general are not written about to the same level as men. So actually finding the sources to be able to write the articles is a huge challenge. And there is kind of an ongoing systematic bias where women's biographies tend to be held unconsciously to a higher standard. So they're more likely to be deleted because people tend to scrutinize them a little bit closer in an unconscious way than they would a male contemporary.
Why do you think there is this gender gap in the Wikipedia editors themselves? Like, why aren't more women involved in writing Wikipedia pages?
They don't have the same amount of free time as perhaps their male counterparts. My own kind of anecdotal bias is that women tend to suffer less from the somebody is wrong on the internet and I have to tell them that, that men tend to feel far stronger about.
So one of the ways to undo this disparity in the number of biographies that are about women is that you have taken on this 100-day challenge, I believe. Could you tell us exactly what it is?
It's the 100 Wiki Days. So it was a Bulgarian editor, Vasya, came up with this. She based it on the idea of the 100 Days of Happiness, where you're supposed to kind of come up with a reason to be happy for 100 days consecutively. So she thought, I'm a Wikipedia editor, I'd like to set myself a challenge. So it was to write an article every day for 100 days consecutively. And she's quite strict on, you know, if you break your 100 days, then you have failed your challenge, which I quite like, you know. So I've done that twice. I did it in 2015 and 2018. I'm focusing on the women's biographies. So for every 19 articles that I write on a woman, I write one on a man.
Oh, there's something so satisfying about that. That pleases me.
So a lot of people have quite a bit of spare time right now. And if anyone listening to this thinks, oh, I could get involved with that, but they'd never done it before, how would you recommend they start going about learning how to create and edit Wikipedia pages?
There's loads of resources out there. You know, if you just Google how to start editing Wikipedia, you'll find stuff of varying quality. I have started a Twitch stream, and I started right from this is how you set up an account. I'm taking requests if people have a specific thing that they want to learn how to do. So it's just me, you know, in my own COVID bunker. And I also have two live streams of how I go about creating an article from scratch.
I was on your Twitch page just this morning and I saw a clip of you editing a Wikipedia page in Irish, I think. Is that something you do a lot or do you mostly focus on English?
I mostly focus on English. It's because my Irish is absolutely woeful. Like, you know, I can manage certain amounts of very basic translation. So what I had done there was I was creating, there was no article on Wikipedia for badminton.
Badminton, the sport.
Exactly, yes. I have absolutely zero interest in the sport of badminton. I don't think I've ever played it willingly. And you couldn't pay me to watch it, but I have started editing articles related to historic badminton players for some unknown and bizarre reason.
So despite the fact that there was no badminton page for the Irish language, Wikipedia is actually, it's quite strong generally on being a platform that involves a huge range of regional and indigenous languages. And you, I believe, were going to be working on a conference coming up if it weren't for the current shutdown, a Celtic Knot conference. What does it mean for you, the fact that Wikipedia is able to support and keep some of these languages alive?
So Celtic Knot is going ahead. It was going to be in Limerick this year, but now it's going to be remote. So we are going to have 2 days of events on the 9th and 10th of July around minority languages and Wikimedia projects. Historically, Celtic Knot was kind of around, quite obviously, Celtic languages. But I think what's interesting is that when you get people who are involved in Indigenous and minority languages, quite often a lot of the barriers that they have are quite similar. And there are varying different levels to that. I mean, some struggle because they don't actually have an accepted written form of their language. So Berber in Morocco, Northern Sami in Norway can sometimes struggle that the language community themselves have differing ways of writing their language. And equally then access to, you know, physical hardware that then you can write successfully in your own language can be quite challenging. But it's very heartening and I think creates kind of a lot of community if you realize, okay, I might come from a very minority language Wikipedia like Maltese, but I have a certain amount of knowledge that I can share of the things that we've learned, how we've managed to kind of crowdsource and crowd create tools and methods to make our lives easier, and that they can be then of use to a language from, you know, completely the other side of the world. So there's a huge amount of camaraderie in that, that I think events like the Celtic Knot are really important to make language communities feel less alone and less isolated than they usually do on a day-to-day basis.
Something that I'm completely obsessed with, Rebecca, as soon as a celebrity dies, I will like go on their Wikipedia page, and like just after the breaking news, they will have been declared dead already. And I was just wondering, are there Wikipedia editors who specialise in updating celebrities' pages as soon as they die?
The short and unsexy answer is yes.
Wow.
There is a niche Wikipedian for nearly everything. Some people will kind of affiliate themselves with certain kind of types of work. But then there's also people who are referred to as wiki gnomes. And wiki gnomes will do kind of very specifically grammatical changes. You know, they'll weed out incorrect uses of commas.
That's me. I did this like once or twice about 8 years ago. Just some punctuation that really annoyed me. That's the only thing I've ever done on Wikipedia. I'm a gnome.
You could be a gnome. And the majority of edits that are done on Wikipedia are by what's referred to as anonymous editors. So there are editors that follow me around cleaning up my messes I created.
Some people are sometimes a bit snooty about Wikipedia and talk about it being full of mistakes and inaccuracies. Do you think these criticisms are unfounded? Do you think it's actually a pretty accurate place? Or do you still think there are areas in this Wikiverse that aren't quite perfect?
It really depends on the subject that you're looking at. You know, if you're looking at the article on, you know, George Bernard Shaw or Picasso, those articles are going to have been combed over by hundreds, if not thousands, of editors and very heavily scrutinized. And they're probably going to be very heavily monitored for vandalism or for disruptive edits or unhelpful edits, as we would refer to them. As you move to more and more niche topics, you're getting less and less editors engaging with that. And perhaps the content, the quality of the content is going to suffer based on that. There is an awful lot of time and effort from news outlets, you know, giving time and effort to going, such and such as Wikipedia article has been vandalized. And, you know, somebody put in a cheeky edit that lasted probably less than 5 minutes, but somebody screen grabbed it and thinks it's hilarious and it gets into the news cycle. So that is very much in people's minds. Yeah, there are constantly people vandalizing Wikipedia, but generally those edits last minutes, if not seconds, before they reverted. It's a very hard thing for people to shake because they have been told for so long that Wikipedia is unreliable and written by Joe Soap, so therefore it has to be wrong.
I saw a great Eurovision Wikipedia tweet. Someone tweeted, "I pledge to dedicate the rest of my life to changing the Wikipedia article for Eurovision 2020 to show Iceland as the winners, whatever it takes."
I think we can all agree that they did essentially win this year, despite the fact that Eurovision didn't happen.
Yeah, I think so too. Although we do not condone factually incorrect additions to Wikipedia, but they would have won.
They should have won. Rebecca's very useful How to Edit Wikipedia Page tutorial videos are available on YouTube. We will post a link.
For our happy ending, I want to talk about Molly, a dog living in Scarborough in the UK, who's become a bit of a celebrity because she collects trash from beaches willingly.
Aww.
Her owner, Fliss, taught Molly to collect trash as a fun game when she was a puppy, and Molly seems to enjoy it. And it's incredibly nice for all the local residents and for the environment. Fliss recycles what she can and keeps a lot of the plastic toys found to give to local artists who incorporate them into their artwork. Do you want some plastic things to make some art?
Sure, yeah.
Now you've finished your jigsaw puzzle.
I've got nothing to do, it's quite true.
It's been 2 years since Molly started cleaning the beaches, and she's said to have collected 250,000 pieces of beach litter. So thank you, Molly, for your hard work.
This is quite ingenious. Do you think we could teach small children to do this as well? Turn like rubbish collection to a fun game. I might teach my niece.
Maybe that's child labour.
Yeah, but you know, with a good cause.
Did you see they're trying to train some dogs to be able to sniff out COVID?
Yes, I love this. Dogs are the best. I like that this podcast has gone full circle from celebrity animal to celebrity animal.
They're the things keeping us sane right now, animals. you have any isolation inspiration this week, Katie?
I've got quite a trashy recommendation this week, but I started the Spanish Netflix series Elite.
Oh, I also started it.
What do you think?
I decided I could not continue, I'm afraid.
I'm quite enjoying it. I've only done one episode, but it's kind of like a bit like Cruel Intentions.
Yeah, meets Gossip Girl.
So it's set in a high school. It's a really fancy high school in Spain. And there's lots of like fancy kids, but it's also quite dark and a bit murdery.
My sister taught at an international school in Spain with loads of politicians' kids. I've been meaning to ask her, is this really what it's like? I mean, I'm sure they're not all such glamorous people.
It made me feel kind of weirdly nostalgic, though, for the times when I used to watch like The OC and lots of kind of trashy teenage dramas. So it was like it had an update as well, because it has lots of, you know, modern themes like homophobia and racism and stuff like that.
Modern themes. Homophobia, racism. What a great time we live in.
Those are new things. What have you been watching or reading or otherwise consuming?
I have actually just started reading Flights by Olga Tokarczuk. How do you say it?
I read that last year. I have no idea how you pronounce it.
I'm only like 50 pages in, but I'm kind of a bit befuddled by it and also gripped. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, but it was hard work.
It won the Man Booker Prize and she won the Nobel Prize after having this book published. So yeah, it's quite a lauded piece of literature. So I thought it was about time to give it a go.
The thing I really liked about Flights is that it feels like a really pan-European novel, which is really nice.
It's all about travelling.
Yeah, that thing that we can't do anymore.
Yeah, so good time to read it. Give it a try. Let us know what you think. Or if you've already read it, then let us know what you think.
That's all we have time for this week. But we will be back next week. As always, we're going nowhere. In the meantime, you can find us on all of the social media networks, including Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram at Europeans Podcast, Facebook. If you just type in the Europeans Podcast, you'll find us. And send us an email. Send us book recommendations. hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Have a good week, everyone, and we will see you next Wednesday. Looking forward to it.
You really sound like you are.
I'm just bracing myself for being forced to talk about Bonds again. Don't make me.
Yay! Tune in next week for Dominic's Bond special. Bye!